The Association of Classical and Christian Schools presents Repairing the Runes, the 2018 ACCS Annual Conference, copyright 2018. You may make additional copies of this recording for use by your school, but please do not sell any copies of the recording. Learn more about classical Christian education and ACCS at classicalchristian.org.
Welcome to, this is a seminar called All Things Vile and Vicious, Seeing God's Glory and the Horrors of Nature. My name's Jeffrey Mays. I was going to just skip over, but this is being recorded. I was going to skip over my life and bio, but since it's being recorded and whoever's listening can't look it up in the program, I'll just tell you. My undergraduate was a computer science degree from Baylor University. I have a Master of Divinity from Covenant Theological Seminary. I was a pastor in the PCA for 4 years. I began teaching students right out of college. I've taught now and again all through my life. My first teaching assignment was as a substitute teacher. Over the years, I've taught in public, private schools, and homeschooling. My most recent teaching experience was at Regent School of Austin, where I taught Bible, apologetics, and ancient history. That was some years ago. I'm now back in school again. This time I'm pursuing an MFA, Master of Fine Arts degree at Seattle Pacific University in their creative writing program. I have one novel published by AEC Stellar Publishing, which is now a defunct indie publisher, and some other short stories. My current day job is Director of Marketing for Novali Science and Math. We publish rigorous mastery-based science curriculum for 7th through 12th grade. So let's start with the title. The title of the seminar is taken from an old 19th century children's hymn, singing all about the sweet and gentle animals that God made. All Things Bright and Beautiful is the name of it. So I have a little snip of the first verse here, so let's listen to that if this is going to work. The topic of this talk is a result of my thoughts over several years. We're all aware that there are more creatures that God made than just the cute and fluffy ones. Actually, there are vastly more creatures that are ugly, unpleasant, and even hideous than there are pleasant ones. And as I started thinking about these things, I started actually by thinking about a zoomed-in photo of the face of a fly. Have you ever looked at a fly's face close up? Their eyes kind of look like Kevlar vest or something like that. They're just very creepy-looking close up. I started thinking about, what does it mean that God made such creatures? Does He delight in monsters? Are we therefore supposed to delight in monsters? The violent, the filthy, the allergenic? Rhetorical questions. Let's change gears. Like much that has happened in the last 200 years, in science, the knowledge about the animal kingdom has exploded. You all know amazing new species are being discovered on almost daily, and the way we present the animal kingdom to our students, therefore, I think, is in need of updating. We're going to look at a few pictures, perhaps some unsightly creatures, animals, and we're going to talk about some of the more unnerving behaviors that we see in the animal kingdom, such as predation, parasitism, and fecundity. which I will define, so don't worry. So here we go. Much of our talk about animals remains in the 19th century. But what we are learning through the discoveries of the lovers of creation known as scientists is that the animal kingdom is not the storybook version that has been carefully cleaned up and sanitized and made safe for children. I have a second version of that hymn that illustrates this fact. So, I want to start with a tricky question. Is all creation fit for children? Are there works of God that you believe are not suitable for children? There are probably people here who would say, yes, certainly all creation is fit for children. All God's works give Him praise and are therefore fit for children. It is absurd and even irreverent to say otherwise. On the other hand, there may be some here who would say, no, there are some aspects of creation that require maturity. For example, we don't tell our kids about sex until they're older, and there are some scary animals that might give them nightmares. It is absurd to think otherwise, and perhaps even irreverent. So the question turns out to be more difficult than it appears on the surface, and the opinions will change from scruples from one parent to the next and from one culture to the next. As I get older, as I've gotten older, I am less and less able to defend not telling children about sex from even an early age, but that is a subject for another day. We cannot deal adequately with every facet here, but my intention is to try to focus on science education and the advantages of exposing our students to the full spectrum of God's works, even the parts that are shocking, and even in early years. You may be wondering, why? Why do we need to talk about this? I will argue that it's important because it reflects our assumptions that we bring to teaching, which will either knit students to God and to God's works, or perpetuate cultural assumptions that render young students theologically flaccid, a zoological equivalent of Joel Osteen religion. So let's first get a few scriptures out in front of us. Genesis 1:1, God created the heavens and the earth. When we teach that God created everything, students should be given a chance to reflect on the implications of God making those shocking creatures too. Did God make that? Why? Is that included in what he called very good? I don't think it's good. Is there something wrong with me? Is there something wrong with God? Did demons make that creature? What would it be like, what would it feel like for me to overcome my repugnance enough to be able to find God's glory in that unsightly creature? A few other scriptures. Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Day to day they pour forth speech, night to night reveal knowledge. I take this verse to extrapolate nicely down to creatures of every kind, including the naked mole rat. In Psalm 148, the psalmist writes, praise him, sun and moon, praise him, all you stars. Jump down a bit, for he commanded, and they were created. Praise the Lord from the earth, you sea monsters, and you scorpions, and flies, and naked mole rats. Psalm 111, great are the works of the Lord, studied by all who delight in them. Verse 4, he has caused his wondrous works to be remembered. When we teach that God made everything, students should be given a chance to reflect on the implications of God also making these creatures. There's two reasons, at least. One, because young kids can handle it, perhaps better than adults can. And two, because we're trying to raise adults. We're not raising children, we're raising adults who can interact maturely with their world. And hiding parts of God's creation from them says more about us than it does about them and their ability to deal with it. It says that we don't think that all God's creation is suitable for children. Can God be trusted with our children? Or at least says that we're fickle, only wanting to pick the brightest flowers and leave behind the grass. We treat God's world like a beauty contest. We praise the lovely. We focus on the sweet, the cute, the noble, the majestic. Or we ignore the unsightly. But what does this say about our faith, our relationship with God, and the substance of our religion? Are we living in our own VBS, Vacation Bible School, fantasy world and afraid to actually look at the world that God actually made? There are a lot of poets, philosophers have wrestled with this question. This isn't something new. It's been thought of for a long time. William Blake has two classic poems that are juxtaposed that illustrate this idea. So let's enjoy them together. This is The Lamb. First, this was taken from William Blake's collection called Songs of Innocence. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Gave thee life and bid thee feed by the stream and o'er the mead. Gave thee clothing of delight, softest clothing, woolly, bright. Gave thee such a tender voice, making all the vales rejoice. Little lamb, who made thee? Dost thou know who made thee? Little lamb, I'll tell thee. Little lamb, I'll tell thee. For he is called by thy name. For he calls himself a lamb. He is meek and he is mild. He became a little child. I a child and thou a lamb. We are called by his name. Little lamb, God bless thee. Little lamb, God bless thee. And now, the other poem by William Blake, The Tiger, from his Songs of Experience. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? In what deeps or skies burnt the fire of thine eyes? On what wings dare he aspire? What the hand dare seize the fire? And what shoulder and what art could twist the sinews of thy heart? And when thy heart began to beat, what dread hand and what dread feet? What the hammer, what the chain? In what furnace was thy brain? What the anvil, what dread grasp dare its deadly terrors clasp? When the stars threw down their spears and watered heaven with their tears, did he smile his works to see? Did he who made the lamb make thee? Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye dare frame thy fearful symmetry? Perhaps by now you have detected that my real concern in this talk is not to hold forth some urgent plea on behalf of the unsung animals left out of school curriculum. If you thought that, you are correct. This is really a vehicle to urge teachers of all subjects and parents and students and humans of every sort to look more at the world, to be in it, to meditate on it. If you read your Bible daily, then you should meditate on God's other book of revelation just as often, the book of his works. Because Psalm 19 just told us that that the heavens declare the glory of God. The heavens speak day to day. They pour forth speech. I am not exaggerating when I say that I think much of the ills of the modern world result from our inattention to the book of God's works, which is the world we live in. I do not have a good segue here for the idea of God as an artist, so I'm just going to plunge right in. The idea of seeing God's creation as his art has become my favorite metaphor for thinking about him. God is an artist, the first artist, and the model for all human artists which were to follow. Jacques Maritain, the 20th century French philosopher, wrote this. In the sense in which the, this is for all you, some Latin for all you classical types. In the sense in which the gospel says, unus est bonus Deus, which translated means there is only one who is good, God. So we may say, unus est artifex Deus, there is only one artist, God. The poet Lucy Shaw goes further. She says, God was the first quilter of prairies, the primal painter, night skies, ferns, thunderheads, snow on cedars, the archetypal sculptor, mountain ranges, icebergs, the composer who heard the whales' strange sonorous clickings and songs in his head before there were whales to sound them. Just as a human artist takes delight in his finished work, the playwright who plotted the sweeping drama of creation, incarnation, and redemption, and he's the poet whose word said it all. I started to say, all scientists today, believers and non-believers, derive their artistic impulse from God's original art making, which we call creation, from the operation of God's original imagination. He imagined it. Just as a human artist takes delight in his finished and final product, so God delighted in his art. And he declared it very good. Now, a gifted artist can take things that are bright and make things bright and lovely, can make them comedic, can make them noble, and that same artist can make works that are dark, sinister, tragic, portraying ignoble things. Shakespeare wrote comedies, histories, and tragedies. Surely Shakespeare himself wept when he first saw Romeo and Juliet dead on the stage. I think that he probably wept when he saw Hamlet and Laertes lying dead on the stage. And I think that when the curtain fell, he said, wow, what a story. What? But the hero, he's dead. Yeah, what a story. I think God is, this is a really fruitful line of thought that I'm not going to pursue, but I think that God can look at the human drama. So many individual lives, epic sweeping things. I think that God looks at this, and God being God, he looks at the entirety of the human story, and when the end curtain falls, he's going to turn to his angels and say, wow, what a story. Creation, fall, redemption. Some other artists. Mozart could compose the Requiem Mass on one hand, and he could also compose the little pablum tune that we know today as Twinkle, Twinkle, Little Star. The same is true for great painters, composers, poets, sculptors. They make some art that is grand and glorious, and other art that portrays melancholy, grief, major and minor keys, dark and bright colors. Why should God not be the same? Or better, don't human artists derive their variety of expression from God who did it first? When we survey the range of God's creation, what do we see? We see that there are majestic lions, stately elephants, cuddly kittens, humorous geese, agile gazelles. But we also see poisonous snakes, scraggly hyenas and wicked-looking spiders, nightmarish anglerfish, and simply the ugly naked mole rat. Like the artists we're familiar with, God's palette contains bright colors and dark. God has as much of an artist's satisfaction in the creepiness of a scorpion whose pinchers and stinger he made as he does the placidity of ducks and the playfulness of meerkats. What we don't want to do is pronounce judgment on God's works that we do not like and begin to rationalize that the good, loving, friendly, forgiving God that we claim to believe in would never create such ugly, horrible creatures, and therefore start attributing them to the devil or saying that they're a part of the curse of Adam and Eve following the fall of man. We should not make God out to be so shallow as an artist. If man can make great works, bright and dark, surely God can. Some of you may like that hymn. It's not my desire to be iconoclastic, but it's not my favorite hymn. I'm not crazy about it, because it has a kind of an anti-education lesson that it presents to us as we think about teaching science. If our lessons on zoology avoid the creepy, the slimy, the violent animals, if we just imagine the animals in Noah's Ark Noah's Ark having only the fun zoo animals, the giraffes, elephants, and monkeys, if our students' encounter with the world focuses only on the furry and the familiar, then like the cultural petting zoo, we're doing our students a disservice, or worse, we're perpetuating in our students and ourselves a sort of storybook experience of the world which will not serve them in the modern world. And when it comes to engaging our students with God's creation, a mature teacher, a good teacher, one who is trying to help rear students and children into adults, we'll give the students opportunities to wrestle with their own, what I'm going to call animal prejudices, and hopefully arrive at a framework that includes parts of creation they find unpleasant, nevertheless encompassed in the domain of God's good works. I'm going to give two examples from my own life. The first one, when my kids were young, I read to them, as you all do. In addition to Treasure Island and King Solomon's Mines and the Harry Potter series, we also read the sometimes unsettling stories of Hans Christian Andersen. Some of their favorite stories to this day are the dark tales of Nathaniel Hawthorne, young Goodman Brown, and the minister's black veil and the birthmark. I read these stories even though other adults around, including my wife, were not so sure it was a good idea, but I still believe it was. The second example comes from my 18-year-old son, the last of four, who's about to leave the nest. He is handsome, ambitious, kind, hardworking, intelligent, and gentle. But he cannot stand bugs. We joke about it sometimes. He hates to mow the lawn for fear that a grasshopper will jump on his leg or a wasp will sting him. He would much rather, and he is elected to do the dishes every night rather than once a week or once every 2 weeks to mow the grass. In retrospect, I wonder if handling bugs had been a part of his life from infancy and every day since, I'm sure that we could have avoided this childish phobia, which I'm sure he will grow out of, as I did. Toddlers have not learned what to be afraid of. As they grow, they see how adults respond to the world. When they see people running in fear from rats, shivering at the sight of a roach, or that, like Indiana Jones, I hate snakes, then they learn to do the same. On the other hand, when they see respected adults showing fascination and wonder at every kind of creature, praising God for his handiwork, marveling at the unique features and unique abilities of every species, such enthusiasm is contagious. Now I want to show you some a couple of slides where I want to consider how our consciousness toward animals has changed in the last few centuries. In pre-modern times, most people's familiarity with animals consisted of their goats and cows, plus whatever wild animals they might see in the forests and prairies, buffaloes, reindeer, llamas, whatever, horses. Even in ancient times, travelers to faraway lands brought tales back to, the Roman Empire of strange animals they saw. Last summer, I finished City of God, Augustine's City of God last summer. I did it on audiobook. It is super long and can be tedious, but very rewarding. I loved it. So many good things. And Augustine talks about this creature that he had heard tale of. Well, what he had heard of other ones like Siamese twins and a man completely covered in hair like some wolf man and other weird creatures. But one he talked about had a single leg, one long leg, and at the bottom of his leg was one big foot, like a boat, this huge foot that came out. And they hopped around like this. And when they would sleep at night, they would lay on their back and throw that foot up over them for shade. Does anybody recognize that? C.S. Lewis, The Voyage of the Dawn Treader, that's right. They come onto an island, they hear this thumping around them, they don't know what it is, it turns out these creatures are invisible, the spell is broken, and they see them, and that's it. These things hop around, and when they sleep, they lie down and drop their foot over them, over their head for shade. So I just love that. When I heard that in the City of God, I went, C.S. Lewis! So these images, these medieval images here, show the strange features of animals that they had heard tales of. Notice that they have trumpets on their snouts, the elephants and whatever those things are on the left. We don't really know why they conceived them that way, but this is kind of them drawing pictures of stories that they had heard. Herman Melville talks derisively about the wild inaccuracies in the books of zoology in the decades before his time. This is from Moby Dick. There's a chapter you may remember. He scorns this image by William Hogarth, the 18th century cartoonist and painter, as an egregious and misleading example. You see it may be a little difficult to see. There's a picture of a whale there on the left side. Not very realistic at all. He also castigates Goldsmith's Natural History, which was even more recent in his time, 1826. It's getting better, but they're still fantastical pictures, false portrayals of whales. So what I just wanted you to see in this is how, as we have come to, in the West, to closer and closer centuries, our familiarity with these creatures has become a little more accurate. And now we have, of course, media and TV and everything. We can see these creatures actually the way they are. So let's turn now to a discussion of some of the aspects of the animal kingdom that have the potential to do three things. A, to show us new things about our Creator God. Who wants to know something new about your Creator God? B, to bring us into company with the scientists who have spent a lot of time studying these things in depth. And C, to inform Christian worldview matters. Fecundity. If you're not familiar with this word, it means the degree to which a creature produces offspring, referring especially to those creatures who produce spectacular amounts of young. You've probably heard about these species that have hundreds or even thousands of offspring in every mating season. Ignore that quote at the bottom. I'm going to come back to that in a minute. Everybody knows the movie Finding Nemo, right? We've all seen it, but I guarantee you all your students have seen it. It has this opening scene where the mother clownfish has just laid about 500 eggs, and cherishes each one, only to have all but one eaten by a barracuda in a deeply saddening act of violence. It's not sad in real life, of course, and I'm sure it happens in the world every ordinary day, unobserved by human eyes and unmourned and without drama. Rabbits have a great reputation for fecundity. Rabbits are mature enough to reproduce at only 4 months old, and they can be ready to mate again immediately after giving birth. The litter can consist of 4 to 12 babies. The litter is known as a kit, and they can bear such kits many times over the course of their lives. Because of the rapid reproduction rate, mice can grow in population from 6 to 60 in just 3 months. This may be of interest to you if you live on a farm. The typical female produces 5 to 10 litters a year, almost one a month, with 5 to 6 babies in each one, and the young can begin to reproduce at 30 days of age. It is perhaps fortunate for us that mice have a high mortality rate. Seahorses are quite fascinating. They are famously monogamous, and it is the males that give birth, not the females. They can bear from 150 to 2,000 babies in a single season. The birth process, if you've not seen the video, you have to go see the video of a seahorse giving birth. It resembles something like a confetti cannon. That's all I can say. Bluefin tuna can produce 10 million eggs in a year. The African driver ant is reported by some sources to be the most fecund species, producing 3 to 4 million eggs every 25 days. A 2017 census of Los Angeles had it just under 4 million, so every 25 days. Enough examples. Annie Dillard calls fecundity appalling. Her comments are so visceral that I want to quote her at length. She says this: fecundity is, quote, teeming evidence that birth and growth, which we value, are ubiquitous and blind. That life itself is so astonishingly cheap that nature is as careless as it is bountiful. The landscape of Earth is dotted and smeared with masses of apparently identical individual animals. The oceanic breeding grounds of pelagic birds are teeming and cluttered as any human Calcutta. Lemmings blacken the earth and locusts the sky. Gremlin run thick in the ocean. Corals piles on piles, and protozoans explode in a red tide stain. Ants take to the skies in swarms. Mayflies hatch by the millions, and molting cicadas coat the trunks of trees. A lone aphid, she says, breeding for 1 year, would produce so many living aphids that, although they are only a tenth of an inch long, together they would extend into space 2,500 light years. Let lace wings eat enormous numbers of aphids. The adults mate in a fluttering flush of instinct. They lay eggs and die by the millions at the first cold snap of fall. The pressure of growth among animals is a kind of terrible hunger. These billions must eat in order to fuel their surge to sexual maturity so that they may pump out more billions of eggs. I feel like Ezra. Quote, and when I heard this thing, I rent my garment and my mantle and plucked off the hair of my head and my beard, and I sat down astonished. She continues, what kind of world are we living in? Why not make fewer eggs or larvae and give them a decent chance? Are we dealing in life or in death? If an aphid lays a million eggs, several might survive. Now, my right hand, in all of its human cunning, could not make one aphid in 1,000 years. But these aphid eggs, which run less than a dime a dozen, which run absolutely free, can make aphids as effortlessly as the sea makes waves. Wonderful things wasted. It is a wretched system. One hesitates to try to explain. All I can say is that in God's providence, such reproductive rates are essential to the maintenance of other species. Mice, for example, are the main prey of owls. Without large numbers of mice, we would not be able to enjoy the company of owls. It's not just a cartoon idea, the circle of life. Animals are reproducing and consuming each other at unimaginable rates. Which brings us to our next topic. Predation is when one organism feeds on another. We often visualize predation as a tiger pouncing on the antelope in the African savanna. But let's talk about some less cliche predation. Consider these predation scenarios, which, by the way, children happen to find fascinating. Kids look on in amazement and horror when ants gather in armies to overwhelm and consume larger prey, such as caterpillars, reptiles, or birds. Another method of predation involves the injection of venom into subdue prey, such as snakes, spiders, ants, frogs, and numerous other species. And it's interesting to note that the creatures are outfitted with very finely tuned and precision instruments and body parts that are amazingly efficient at subduing prey. Well, so efficient, in fact, that one could justly conclude that they were made that way by God. Vultures are carnivorous, but they don't even kill their own prey. They feed on the animals already dead. Plutarch said that this behavior of vultures seems so bizarre, so unnatural, that vultures were considered by some ancients to be from another realm altogether, not even from Earth. Anyone who has owned a cat has observed that sometimes they kill birds or mice just for the sport of it, for the delight of it, with no apparent intention of eating them. Such behavior seems to support the widespread belief that cats are actually sociopaths, killing for pleasure rather than a desperate plea to stay alive. A whale's mouth. Children know this. It's commonly discussed in elementary school. They have this thing called a baleen, which is like a filter that they could filter hundreds of krill, zooplankton, and other small fish in a single swallow. There's other types of fish that lunge at a whole school. These lunge feeders are called rorquals, which is hard to say, a rorqual. And they have this amazing hunting ability to expand the size of their jaws large enough to encompass the volume of their own entire body. They could eat themselves. Their mouths get so big. And they use these enormous fishing net mouths to scoop up an entire school of smaller fish. Predation is common and accepted, though it is subject of great contemplation. Every child knows that tiny creatures are fed upon by larger creatures, which are in turn fed upon by larger creatures, and so on. Like fecundity, predation also occurs at a spectacular and constant rate. John Steinbeck, in his book, The Law of the Sea of Cortez, describes this as he looked over the gunwale of the boat that he was in the Pacific Ocean, and he observed fishes, sharks, and sea beasts swimming alongside his boat, feasting upon each other with, quote, with furious exuberance. And everyone knows Tennyson's famous poem, In Memoriam, A.H.H., which contains a famous phrase, nature red in tooth and claw. Combined with fecundity, predation presents a spectacular phantasmagoria of a scale that is impossible to imagine. Billions and trillions of creatures spawned every day and consumed each day. And we're not done. There's one more. Parasitism. Parasitism may be considered a subset of predation. Parasites have been defined by E.O. Wilson as predators that eat their prey in units of less than one. The parasite is often is different from a normal predator in that it has an interest in preserving the life of the host at least long enough to survive and reproduce. We all know about parasites, so I'll just give one example, perhaps the most morbid parasite. As bad as any horror movie is the Glyptopantanal wasp. You can find videos if you dare. National Geographic. These are wasp varieties that inject their eggs into the bodies of living caterpillars. The caterpillar goes on about its business as if it doesn't know what's going on, but inside, the larvae grow, molting, shedding their exoskeletons. As the larvae grow, the caterpillar's body swells up. When the larvae are mature, they all emerge together, bursting out of the body of the caterpillar in the space of an hour. The caterpillar survives this, by the way. But they're not done with him. In the following phase, the wasp larvae gestate in a web of cocoons outside the caterpillar's body. Not only does the caterpillar become the incubator for the wasp larvae in some kind of alien body snatcher scenario, but after the emergence of the larvae, it becomes a kind. The caterpillar is a kind of zombie slave, and it protects the larvae, so that until they mature. Eventually, the caterpillar dies by starvation, and the baby wasps emerge from their cocoons and fly away. It is hard to know what to do with such animal behavior. That makes our stomach turn. I'll offer some thoughts below from a moral, theological, or philosophical standpoint, but for the sake of education, we face our original question. Is creation suitable for children? Would you shrink from telling your students about the Glyptopantanal wasp? Not all parasites, of course, are so macabre. Humpback whales have a kind of a whale lice that they live in the symbiotic and beneficial relationship. In fact, most parasites have a beneficial relationship with their host. Perhaps this is a major part of the issue. That things strike us as dark and horrible, they may simply be because of our particular Western 21st century Disney-fied sensibilities that form an interpretive grid that makes us squeamish. Perhaps the creator artist who made the world does not see it the way we do. Perhaps in God's creation economy, in ways that are higher than our ways, all these behaviors we see are very good. Is that possible? If it is, then who are we to say otherwise? Who are we to say, what hath God wrought? One way that some Christians try to resolve the unpleasantness we observe is to ascribe the predatory behavior to sin. The idea is that before the fall of Adam and Eve, animals were vegetarians. One problem with this, other than the fact that it says this nowhere in the Bible, is that it is really just an all too easy answer, quickly and easily dispensing with the problem. Another problem is that it paints God as an unspeakable monster. And here's why. What was Satan's punishment in the Garden of Eden? To crawl on his belly and eventually to be subdued by the offspring of the woman. What was Eve's punishment in the Garden of Eden? Her punishment was increase in pain in childbirth and to be under the rule of her husband. What was Adam's punishment in the Garden of Eden? Banishment from the garden and He would have to work hard to grow crops. But the animal kingdom, in this scenario, if predation, fecundity, and parasitism is a result of sin, then the animal kingdom, who didn't do anything wrong, who is made up of dumb animals, suffers a daily, epic holocaust just to get food when they could have just gone on eating plants. Why would God make carnivorous behavior a result of Adam and Eve's disobedience? It doesn't make sense. Isaiah 65:25 is often used to try to build a case for this. The wolf and the lamb will feed together. The lion will eat straw like an ox. The dust will be the serpent's food. They will neither harm nor destroy in all my holy mountain, says the Lord. The problem with this is it doesn't really hold up either. These words are in an Old Testament prophetic book, and prophetic literature is subject to figurative interpretation. Not only that, but this is not describing the Garden of Eden. It's describing the future state. It doesn't work to say that the future state of heaven, that God is merely going to return nature to the way it was before the fall, because the heavenly paradise is much, much, much better than the Garden of Eden. Eden was not a perfect place. Adam and Eve were able to sin, for one. For another thing, they had to work the garden. They had to work it. They had to tend the garden, or else it would become overgrown. And finally, Satan was in the garden. I very much hope that Satan is not around to tempt us in the future paradise of heaven. We're just left with a mystery. But I want to suggest a possible way forward. I don't have any bullet points on this topic because this is off the record. This one's free because this is a result of my speculation. So that's all it is. I submit it to you as my private thoughts. When animals eat each other, it is not immoral. No moral problem there. When humans eat each other, it's called cannibalism, and it's very immoral. Consider that eating flesh appears in the sacrament of communion. Eating Christ's flesh. In fact, it is mandated by Christ as the only way to enter his kingdom. Unless you eat my flesh and drink my blood, you can have no part of me. Why would Christ leverage such an image? The answer is because we take Christ inside of us and we are nourished by him. Exactly. Because meat is nourishing in every other context of human and animal life. But Christ would have us to be spiritually nourished. And of course, he spoke in a metaphor. But if eating meat were the result of the fall and the curse, then why would it be the requirement for entering into the kingdom? Is it possible, as close focus in with me here it is. Is it possible that a certain sacramental relationship exists in nature? Every second of every day, every inch of soil, and every drop of ocean, in ubiquitous and spectacular amounts, when animal eats animal and is nourished thereby. Any day to ask, what kind of world is this? Perhaps we're starting to see. It may be one that is permeated in every inch with sacredness, with sacrament, and with mystery. I want to thank you for your kind attention. I encourage you, no matter what your discipline, to become lovers of the world that God made, students of it. I enjoin upon you reading the books of the great naturalists. I can supply a list if you like. See me afterwards. You read commentaries on the Bible. You read books on Christian living. Read commentaries on God's other works. It's an opportunity to grow in Christian maturity, to love the world God made and his works, and to think deeply about the God who made the strange and bizarre creatures as well as the cute and lovely. Thanks a lot.